From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a look at homicides in the city of Milwaukee with Reggie Moore, the director of the Office of Violence Prevention. Then gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us with tips for planting your lawn this fall.
This year, we escaped a lot of drought. We only had a couple of dry weeks, and so most of our lawns stayed green. But heat and drought usually have our lawns going dormant unless you water, and the weeds thriving. So it was a great weed year, but it was also a good year for our grass.
The enduring appeal of Fiddler on the Roof.
You really don't have to come from the time and place represented in the musical to get something very meaningful out of it.
And Bubbler Talk learns about the mosaics in Mitchell Airport's Concourse C. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. As the weather cools down, so do the levels of violent crime in cities throughout the country, which is why August is one of the months with the highest levels of violent crime in Milwaukee annually. By that measure, the city has been making some progress. There were 10 homicides in the city of Milwaukee this past August compared to 22 over the same month last year. But the city has still experienced more than 60 homicides this year to date. Reggie Moore is director of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about his office's efforts to curb violence in our city, as well as the obstacles.
So since the development and launch of the Blueprint for Peace in 2017, there really has been a concerted effort of bringing as many segments of the community together to engage in violence prevention. And I think it's producing results. When you look at this August alone, so when we look at summer in general, right, we look at the bookends. So typically Memorial Day on the front end, and then we look at Labor Day on the back end. And so for the first time, I think in 7 years, for Memorial Day, we had no homicides in the city. This Labor Day, we had no homicides, but unfortunately we had two non-fatal shootings. And then last year in August alone, in 2018, if you recall, there were 14 homicides in the first 15 days of August 2018. And we ended August of 2018 with a total of 22 homicides. This year, we only had 10. And so in terms of all of the activity, all of the engagement, all of the concerted effort to prevent and respond to violence in our city, I think is having an impact. And so this is the type of effort that we need to see supported and sustained.
Well, and that's what you've been doing this entire time, is looking at violence as a public health issue. What do you see as the pluses and potential obstacles to that mode of working against violence?
The biggest obstacle has been getting people to believe that violence is preventable. We have suffered with so much pain and trauma in our city for so long that people almost made peace with trauma. And I would argue that we should never make peace with pain or with trauma. We should do everything possible to prevent it. And so we may not be able to stop every shooting, right? When you look at random road rage incidents that result in somebody pulling a gun in an argument, that's hard to predict. And, you know, without a targeted intervention with that person, it's hard to prevent those sort of random acts of violence. But when we look at where violence is occurring and what the drivers of violence are, if we can take a place-based approach to say, are there certain neighborhoods with high incidence of non-fatal shootings and high incidence of homicides? If we can look at social networks to say, you know, our community is highly connected, like people know everybody, you know what I mean, in terms of you're probably two or three people away removed from people who are personally touched by violence in this city. And so we get information pretty quickly about what's happening or what's brewing in the street, and we try to take a more proactive approach to get ahead of it. And that's why, you know, we launched the 41 for Life program in partnership with United Garden Homes and Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin, as well as Ascension Healthcare, to really on the front end try to mediate and prevent shootings before they happen. But then on the back end, how do we intervene to reduce the likelihood of retaliation? Most of the shootings in our city are the result of arguments and fights and conflict-related shootings that could be prevented if somebody would step up and be the peacemaker. And so we also try to encourage, promote, and support individuals being what I would call upstanders as opposed to bystanders. So if you know of something that's brewing, or, you know, you're at the club with your friends and there's a fight or argument that's escalating, somebody in that group basically intervening and saying, look, bro, look, sis, like, this isn't worth it. In the event that that doesn't happen or somebody does not do that, I think 414 Life is a stopgap to be able to say, is there somebody you can call, because this particular conflict runs deep and it's been going on for so long that it's going to take more than, you know, a simple conversation. And so that's where our trained interrupters can get involved. And they're from the street, so they understand the life. They understand a lot of the dynamics that drive street violence and gun violence, and have the ability to be able to intervene in a way to de-escalate a situation in a credible way. And so those are all the things that we're doing from a proactive perspective to try to reduce violence in the city, while at the same time calling for addressing some of the systemic factors in terms of concentrated poverty, concentrated mass incarceration, all of the things that create and destabilize families and neighborhoods that also create conditions for violence to flourish.
Can you break down 414 Life, like, just in simple terms, what it is?
So 414 Life is a public health approach that looks at violence as a communicable disease. So the reason, for example, why we have our trauma response partnership with Milwaukee County, the police department, the fire department, and others, is that children who are exposed to violence are more likely to either be victimized by it or perpetuate it in the future, because, again, violence becomes normalized. If I grow up in a house where I see a family member being beaten or violated every day, or when I go in my community and I see most of the conflicts being resolved with fistfights or gunshots, I believe that that's the way that I'm supposed to resolve conflict, or the way that I'm supposed to work through my trauma in terms of abusing other people. And so to the degree that we can break that cycle and understand that we have to, one, be responsive when trauma happens and make sure children get access to counseling immediately, but then we also have to stop that transmission. So with 414 Life specifically, it really is about what we call health workers who are trained in a model that's modeled after the Cure Violence model out of Chicago, that's been implemented in about 70 cities around the world, that basically trains folks from the community who have the background and credibility to be able to predict where conflicts are brewing, to engage with individuals who are part of that conflict and try to de-escalate a conflict before it escalates to the point of physical or gun violence. And so that's essentially that's a huge component of the program. And the hospital partnership allows the interrupters to be paged to the hospital when a gunshot survivor who meets our criteria, meaning folks who are at highest risk of either being re-injured due to gun violence or actually engaging in some form of retaliation, we engage with both the family and the survivor to try to break that cycle and to support that person's recovery physically and psychologically as they recover from being injured by gun violence.
Who are the interrupters? How do you pick them, and what do they do?
So it's a very intensive recruitment process. So we put out a call into the community for folks that are interested in learning conflict mediation and being a part of or engaging in some form of peace building in the city. From that point, the process gets a lot more intensive, right? So we do the sort of open call just to build a list of people who are at least interested in this work. But as we drill down, there's a hiring panel that involves folks from the community, people who have been involved in violence in the city, the health department. It is a very intensive in terms of interview process. Also, members of Cure Violence are part of that hiring panel, because what we want to make sure, number one, is there are people who want to do good, and there are many ways to do good in this city. This is very volatile work, and it takes a high level of credibility and a person that is extremely committed to addressing this issue and not having sort of one foot in, one foot out in terms of the life, but have made a conscious decision and commitment to living a violence-free life. And so I'm really proud of the team that we've recruited. They've been working since November 2018, and all of them don't necessarily have a criminal background, some of them. But again, the critical criteria is the courage, the commitment, and the competence to engage in high-risk and high-intensity violence prevention work in the city.
And how many incidents do you think they've been involved in and potentially stemmed from happening, turning into violence?
Right. So in terms of conflicts mediated in the street, there's been approximately 64. In terms of hospital referrals, in terms of gunshot victims, that have been referred by Frederick Hospital, there's been about 71 of those individuals. And 100% of the patients that have been asked, would you like to talk to a violence interrupter, have accepted. So, in the street sometimes.
Wow, that's interesting.
Right. So you may not have a person on the street that may not be receptive to the message or may not be in a place that they want to change their life. But if you've been shot 3 or 4 times and you're laying in a hospital bed in recovery, you're more apt to that message. And so we want to do everything possible to stop that person from being re-injured. And number two, from feeling like they need to now carry a gun or retaliate against the person who shot them. It really is about bringing folks together, working together, leveraging policies and resources that can seriously address this issue in our city. And we're seeing results.
Talking about those results, do those people, those dozens of individuals who've been shot, who are working with interrupters, get out of the hospital? Have you been seeing results with those individuals?
Right. So some of the things that we track as a result of the 41 for Life program is re-injury. We also are tracking in partnership with Frederick their follow-up support in terms of participating in psych services, because understanding the PTSD that comes from being shot. And so we're actually right now, preliminary data is showing that folks are actually going to their follow-up visits. And so that's extremely, from a mental health perspective, important, but also from a physical recovery perspective is important. We also track in terms of attitudes and behaviors around gun carrying and gun usage among the participants. We call them participants in terms of the caseload that the interrupters support. So it's not just a one touch or one engagement. It really is about working with folks over a period of time and really being committed to their physical recovery, but also their psychological recovery, and then supporting them in terms of housing, employment, AYODA, and other mental health supports and needs. I mean, not just of that individual, but of the family. If someone has been shot, for example, in their home, and their home was shot up, they may not want to return to that house when they're discharged from the hospital. And they also are concerned about their loved ones who lived in the house with them. And so ensuring that the children have access to counseling and mental health supports, ensuring that in terms of loss of income and other issues that could lead to eviction that come as a result of one gunshot. So there's data and research being done around the country that's looking at the cost of gunshot wounds. And the data that we're seeing in terms of looking at cities like St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, Minneapolis, is that the average cost of one gunshot victim and one perpetrator is $1 million. That involves the detective and investigative costs. That involves the hospital costs. It involves the incarceration of the perpetrator and the prosecution of that perpetrator. It also involves, in terms of lost tax revenue, of both the individual that's sent away to prison and then the person who has to recover. And a lot of times there are public health costs in terms of, costs for that person's hospital care because they may be un- or underinsured. And so those are all factors that go into when we talk about gun violence, both as a moral issue, but also as a fiscal issue. It is imperative that we get smarter on public safety by investing in prevention. So if you think about, both combined street and hospital-based interventions, about 140 people have been served as a result of this program, which could have resulted likely in 140 prevention of gunshot victims. And you multiply that by $1 million, it is the return on investment in prevention is clear. The question is there the political will at every level, at the local, state, and federal level, to invest in the prevention to the degree that it deserves? Because unfortunately, as a society, as a country, and as a state, we have not done that. And so it really is critical, and this is the critical juncture now where we have to really step up and be responsive to what the community has told us in the Blueprint for Peace that we should be doing to prevent and reduce violence in this city.
Why do you think we are seeing so many road rage incidents in Milwaukee?
Some would debate that as a result of CCW, whether people are carrying legally or illegally or inappropriately, that people are driving around with firearms in their car. And again, when there's an argument or a conflict, obviously, tempers may flare up in a car accident. You're on your way home or on your way to work or wherever, and you end up in a car accident and you're upset because you're thinking about everything that comes with a car accident, right, in terms of increased insurance costs and the inconvenience of losing transportation. All of that understandably creates a level of anxiety and anger and frustration. The problem is when that escalates and individuals actually have firearms in their car, people again, are making split-second emotional decisions in a moment to pull a gun out and kill somebody over something that's not worth a life. And so, you know, again, you know, people can argue in terms of mental health. They can argue a range of different issues. And again, I don't think road rage is new. I think, you know, there's been incidents of road rage where people get out and fight each other physically. I think what the equation is now people are resorting to lethal means in a moment of rage. And that's something that we have to really grapple with as a community and really have to have conversations in our homes about, is it ideal to drive around with a firearm in your car? And again, we know that people purchase firearms, you know, for home and protection and things like that. But at the end of the day, it is definitely increasing incidents where people are resorting to lethal means to resolve conflicts that could be resolved by legal means, conversation, et cetera. And shooting somebody over a car accident or being cut off in traffic is completely unacceptable.
Do you find that the Office of Violence Prevention is doing any lobbying or submitting any reports to the legislature when it comes to gun policy?
So the city of Milwaukee has been advocating around gun policy for a while. I think the juncture that we're at now is, unfortunately, the legislator seems to react when there's sort of a mass shooting or a series of mass shootings in the country. And so when you look at, for example, last year after the Parkland shooting, where Scott Walker was able to pass an executive order to allocate $100 million to fortify school buildings, I think the question comes down to, how do we fortify our communities? I think when you look at the daily gun violence that happens in cities across this country, there has not been a windfall of resources to address the daily gun violence that happens in cities across this country, which quadrupled the number of people killed in mass shootings in any given year. And so at the end of the day, I think now we have to, again, we have an opportunity to have a comprehensive request, not just a policy request. Policy request is absolutely important, and we support universal background checks. We support red flag laws, but we also need resources for comprehensive violence prevention strategies in local communities. And so things like 414 Life are supported in New York by local funding, but also by state funding. Maryland also has a statewide violence prevention fund. California has a statewide violence prevention fund, and we need one in Wisconsin. And so we need the state legislature as well as the governor to take leadership on this issue and be comprehensive in addressing gun violence in Wisconsin in a complete way, not just looking at policies and laws, because again, those things are important. But at the end of the day, for those that are not going to be deterred by a law or increased penalties, we have to deal with the source of the violence and the source of the trauma, and things like 414 Life and other interventions called for in the Blueprint for Peace require resources that unfortunately Milwaukee doesn't have. We're cash strapped as a result of the status of state share revenue currently in the state that has to be addressed. And so I'm really, you know, calling on state leadership to step up.
Reggie Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
Reggie Moore is the director of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention, and he spoke with WUWM reporter Mayon Silver. You can find more information about Moore's work at WUWM.com. If you thought the cool weather meant the end of gardening season, well, think again. Gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us next. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. As summer turns to fall, many fair-weather gardeners begin to pack up their tools and head inside. But there's still much to be done. Every month, Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers talks with us about all things gardening. She's the author of several books on the topic, including Month-by-Month Gardening in Wisconsin. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers now in the studio.
Melinda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Always a pleasure.
It seems like September is the time to really start focusing on your lawn and grass care. So let's start here. How can the summer impact your lawn?
Often our summers are hot and dry. This year we escaped a lot of drought. We only had a couple of dry weeks, and so most of our lawn stayed green. But heat and drought usually have our lawns going dormant unless you water and the weeds thriving. So it was a great weed year, but it was also a good year for our grass. A lot of heat and drought, usually not so much this year. Early, we had so much rain, and so too much water can be detrimental as well. The lawns seemed to survive unless they were underwater. That can damage the roots and so show up later. And then insects aren't the biggest problem here in Wisconsin, but we do occasionally see things like grubs from the Japanese beetles eating the roots of our grass, chinch bugs, which can feed on the plants as well, and then aphids. So a few insects, not many, but it's usually heat and drought that really stress our lawns. Some diseases because of all the rain this spring. So you put all that together when we're out enjoying the lawn, we're playing on the grass, we're cutting it with the mower, so we're adding to some of the compaction of the soil just by all the activity on our grass.
So something that we had in my lawn this year, and I think it was a number of different things that really impacted this, but we had a patch that had grass and then just suddenly, you know, was really just kind of a mud pile. And with all of the rain, it just became even more of just a mud pile. So we're starting to regrow grass there really from the start. If you're somebody who is just starting off a lawn like that, what should you be doing?
A good point. So take advantage of this bad opportunity, right? You're thinking, ugh, the last thing I want to do is overseed or reseed. But if you have dead patches, adding some organic matter, compost, peat moss to the top, I say 12 inches, hoping you give me 6 or 8. What that does is a couple things. It improves drainage. So many people in southern Wisconsin have heavy clay soil, so it improves the drainage. Those that have rock and sand, it'll help hold the moisture. Adding organic matter also helps when we have all this rain that we've been having in the last few years, so it acts like a sponge. So instead of it running off the lawn into our storm sewer, it's absorbed, and then improving the drainage, it helps filter it down to the groundwater, cleaning out a lot of the dirt and the impurities. So it helps manage stormwater as well as help improve your lawn. And then you're going to rake that. Well, first get rid of the dead stuff. I should have started there. Get rid of the dead stuff if there's anything left. Wait until the soil's moist but not soggy wet. Take a handful of soil, gently squeeze, tap it. If it breaks into pieces, it's moist, perfect for working. If it stays in a mud ball, wait, because you're going to have cracked, compacted soil. And you don't want to spend all this effort to create a new problem. So we've got our soil prepped. And whether you're seeding or sodding, soil preparation is key to longevity. So then we can lay our sod this is a perfect time to seed your lawn. The soil's warm, the air is cool, and the grasses we grow are cool season grasses, bluegrass and fescue and perennial rye, and they thrive in the cooler temperatures of spring and fall. And that's why they did pretty well this summer too, because we had mostly cooler weather. So then you're going to lightly rake the seed in if you're seeding. You're going to lay the sod, if you're going to lay sod, kind of in the pattern like a brick. So you alternate your seams, and then you kind of butt the edges up so that when that sod shrinks a little bit, you'll still have grass there, not a bunch of cracks in the lawn. And then you're going to keep the soil moist. Now, with the cooler weather, that helps us. A lot of rain we've had, that helps. But with seed, you're going to check it every day. And you might be watering at least once a day, maybe twice if we get some warm temperatures, just keeping that top inch or so moist, not soggy wet. With sod, you're going to water thoroughly, again, keeping the soil surface moist because you want those roots to net into the soil below. So you're going to have to do a lot of watering initially. Now, the sod will start to root in a week or so. You gently tug. Then you can back off, water thoroughly and less frequently. As your grass sprouts, then you can do the same, water thoroughly and less frequently. It takes bluegrass up to 3 weeks to sprout. You know, with the warmer soil, maybe a little less. perennial rye is usually mixed in with our grass seed mixes for quick cover. That's usually up in a week to 2 weeks. So the first thing you have is perennial ryegrass, then your bluegrass and fescues come in. Perennial ryegrass isn't always long-lived to the lawn. It's just a placeholder, and it won't overtake your lawn and create problems. Some will survive, and a lot of people use perennial rye for fixing problem areas or high traffic areas as a short-term solution. So we've got our grass started. The one thing I forgot to mention is fertilization. So if you have an established lawn or you're starting a lawn, this is a great time to fertilize. Research found that fall fertilization is probably the best thing we can do for our lawns. And Labor Day is about the time you want to do it. So Labor Day, early September. So if you're doing some seeding, you could fertilize the whole lawn, including that spot you're seeding, and using a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer, something like Milwaukee's own Milorganite, it won't burn or damage those seedlings or the sod. And that way you can do it both tasks at once. Fertilize your whole lawn as well as those areas you're repairing. Or if you're starting a lawn, you can incorporate the fertilizer in with the organic matter when you do your soil prep. Then you're going to watch the grade, so it grades away from the house, get rid of any big chunks. Then you could do your seeding and sodding if you're starting over totally.
That was one of my questions, I guess. When you have these kinds of patches that are popping up that maybe it's completely bare or maybe it's just, you know, kind of yellowed and not gone very well, are there certain ways to deal with that while also ensuring that the rest of your lawn is being cared for properly?
You know, good question. And one of the things is always to figure out why did that happen? You know, and one of the things when I talk to someone with a lawn problem, tell me a little bit, when did this start appearing? Has it been every year? You know, if you have this problem every year, it might be compacted soil, so it's not draining. If it was just this year and water was standing, it could be some root rot. If you can pull your grass up, you know, if you have nothing there to pull up, you know, that's probably not grubs. Grubs, if you pull up the top and there are no roots, you probably, at this time of year, the Japanese beetles are just starting to lay their eggs in the grass, and so you may see some grubs, but they eat the roots of the plants. And so it's doing a little bit of investigation. Some diseases, like melting out, which is Helminthus sporine leaf spot, causes the grass to kind of turn brown, yellow-brown, and then it just melts away, and they call it melting out. Now, I've seen people treat for the disease and not treat for the disease, and at the end of 3 years, the lawns look the same, because you're going to overseed, get a good mix of bluegrass and fescue. So several varieties. When you read the bag, it should have several varieties of bluegrass, several varieties of fescue. Bluegrass, great in the sun. Fescue, more shade tolerant. But if you have a variety of varieties, then you have more disease resistance. And so overseeding with disease resistant grass seed or looking for sod that's known for being resistant is going to help build that up. So that resistance, so you don't have the problem hopefully down the road.
So if you're somebody who's incorporated grasses that are native to Wisconsin into your lawn, how would you care for them this time of year?
So typically if you're using native grasses, you probably have them in either a garden bed versus popping up within your grass, your lawn. And so those native grasses are typically in a garden. And the good news about those is they don't require a lot of care. Enjoy their beauty. This is usually when those native grasses are really starting to shine. They're producing flowers and then seeds. They bring in the birds. A lot of caterpillars feed on the leaves. They're going to go into their glory in fall. Leave them stand for winter. One, you can enjoy them. Two, it increases the hardiness. And then the last thing is in late winter or spring, I typically like to cut them back so that we let the sun reach them, they warm up, and they outcompete the weeds. Chop up. You can put the tops in your compost pile, chop them up. And really, they need very little, if any, fertilization. So those native grasses are a great addition. And all your grasses, a healthy lawn or a natural planting, help capture rainwater so it doesn't run in the storm. So it helps their roots help filter that water before it goes to the groundwater. And one of the reasons I like to talk about lawns as well as the native grasses is a lot of people have lawns. And so I want to help people have a healthy lawn with minimal use of chemicals so that we can really take good care of our waterways as well as our landscape and bring in those birds and those other pollinators as well.
So we've really mostly focused on lawn care. But, you know, when we're talking about fall and we're talking about different plants that might be coming in, what are some of the, you know, fruits. Actually, this is a fruit. I know that squash are fruit. So what are some of the
very good,
and
most people don't. You know, one of the things is it is harvest season. And so knowing when to pick is the greatest thing because you'll get the best flavor and most nutritional value. So if you've got zucchini, this has been a great summer to try to keep up with them. I'll tell you, I've made a lot of zucchini bread because I waited a day or two too long and I had big zucchini fruit to make bread, and not so good when they slice them and fry them and do that. Winter squash, you know, needs to have that rind turn nice and hard, still be glossy. On the underside where it sits on the ground, it usually turns from a green to a cream or an orange color, and you know it's ripe. So that mostly have a little bit longer depending on when you plant it. Watermelons are, I love watermelon, and it can be tricky. And if you get a short season one, especially with our cool summers, you'll be okay. The tendrils near the top start to dry up and curl. And again, the rind is hard, and you kind of get that thud thud when you tap on it. Melons actually start, the vine starts cracking, the stem starts cracking away from the vine. So it tells you it's ready to harvest. Tomatoes, this has been a tough year for those waiting for their first red ripe tomatoes. I'm going to have a lot of tomatoes, I think, in the end of September. It's been so cool that it's delayed harvesting. So wait until they're fully colored. If the animals aren't going to eat them, give them another 5 days on the vine. They'll be even sweeter. I have a lot of ground squirrels, like so many people, right?
Yep.
And if you wait too long, I found one. I'd picked it, set it down, forgot about it, went back. It was half eaten. I was eliminated the problem of climbing up the plant to eat my tomato. So I've been picking mine a little underripe only so that I have some ripe tomatoes. So I put them on my counter, let them ripen up for a couple of days. You can put some in the basement to slow it down, a cooler room anyway. And hopefully we won't have a killing frost for a while, but you can pick your tomatoes as long as they're turning a light green at the bottom or starting to show any color, whether it's yellow, orange, or red, depending on the variety. And you can ripen those inside as well.
Great. Well, Melinda Myers, thanks as always for coming in and speaking with us about lawn care, all things gardening, and sharing so much of your work.
My pleasure. And for tips on just keeping water where it falls, see FreshCoastGuardians.com.
Melinda Myers is the author of several books on gardening. She is a regular contributor to Lake Effect. She spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find more of our conversations with her at WUWM.com. We'll take another break and then hear about a new documentary about a perennial favorite, Fiddler on the Roof. We'll find more about it when Lake Effect Weekend returns on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. One of the most recognizable stories about Jewish experience is the musical Fiddler on the Roof. The story of Tevye, a milkman, and his family and friends opened on Broadway in 1964, and it's seldom been out of production somewhere in the world since then. But what is it that makes the show so timeless and universal? The new documentary Fiddler, Miracle of Miracles, looks at the origin and evolution of this classic musical and what it took to make it the success it continues to be 55 years after its Broadway debut. The documentary will be showing in Milwaukee this Sunday as part of the Milwaukee Jewish Film Festival. Ahead of it, film contributor Dave Lurson joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to talk about it.
One of the world's most recognized fictional characters is a Jewish milkman from a tiny village in pre-revolutionary Russia. Tevye, a recurring figure in the short stories of Yiddish author Sholem Aleichem, danced his way into American popular culture as the protagonist of the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof. From there, he reached the wider world through a popular film that etched the story's characters and songs in memory.
What do you think makes Fiddler on the Roof that quintessentially Jewish musical that speaks to everyone, even if they're not Jewish?
I think it's because everyone comes from a family Some people from loving families that have dissent within the families, which would be more in line with the portrayal in the movie. Virtually everyone came to America from somewhere, except for Native Americans, of course. The conflict between tradition, whatever that means to you, and the demands of the modern world, how to retain what's important, how to change with the times, is something that all of us have faced, I think. I think the movie succeeds very well in speaking beyond the core audience. And what I found interesting in the documentary, Fiddler, A Miracle of Miracles, is the doubtful attitude of many on Broadway toward the success of this movie in 1964. Oh, it'll maybe pack a couple of nights in the hall with Jewish Americans, and it doesn't have enough resonance. It doesn't speak to enough people. But that has proven to be totally wrong. It speaks to a great many people. I think, again, one of the important things, remarkable things about it as a musical and then later on as a film was the ability of the authors of this to take very serious and dark material and still make it entertaining. Even in the darkest moments, this is somehow entertaining. It's not a plunge into depression of any kind. You still have this the lilt of it. Maybe it's the music, the rhythm of the whole thing carries the audience along.
I remember watching it when I was younger and just feeling uncomfortable, like, really? During some scenes. Yeah, just in particular, I'm sure it was like the transitional scene is just like a big, empty, barren field with a sunset and just thinking like, oh, like, you know, just having that feeling where, yes, it's entertaining, but it's also, it depicts a dark time. Mm-hmm. It's not, and I think the documentary brings up a great point that, you know, nostalgia isn't everything, and sometimes nostalgia can be harmful or misleading. What do you think about that aspect?
Well, definitely the case. I've always tried to resist nostalgia in my own life. So if you're nostalgic, if you're looking back at something that you can learn from, if that's what nostalgia can be, that's a very useful thing. If you're simply living in the past, that's not such a good thing. I saw the movie as a 10-year-old probably in the movie theater, one of the rare times I saw a movie on the big screen at that age. Tagged along with my parents. It was my mother's favorite movie of all time because it reminded her of stories that her parents told her of village life in Russia from that same time period. So I was getting it kind of from that angle, too. Was there nostalgia there? You know, in some ways, this was a very functioning community, a strong community of people who were bound together. The individuality was somewhat repressed, and there was danger lurking around the fence of this tradition. So it's a mixed situation, but if people are honest, every situation was a mixed situation for everybody, for every group. I think also I can say, too, that Fiddler is a way of thinking about being repressed or persecuted because of what you are, not who you are as a person, but what you are as part of a group, what you are as part of some definable collection of people who other people may have some prejudice against. And it plays out well beyond, you know, Jews immigrating to the New World. It plays out with every other immigrant group. It plays out with, you know, sexual orientation, with a great many different kinds of things that people have experienced.
Do you think that this was one of the first musicals to accomplish what the documentary referred to as ethnicity becoming pop culture?
Well, I don't think it was the first time it ever happened. I think of a Andrew Sisters song sung in Yiddish that was a big hit during the 1940s. I mean, you could find examples
Amir
of
Mish
things.
Duchesne.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, so we could sit here and talk about that and find a lot of examples, but I think that Fiddler on the Roof was a sort of turning point in some way, maybe because of the mass appeal of it, the way it sort of filtered into, you know, high school productions. I don't know what year the first high school production was, but I think kind of quickly it went beyond Broadway. It has endured like the great musicals of earlier in the 20th century, Oklahoma and so on. I mean, it's up there with them as something that's left a very lasting and ongoing impression on people.
The documentary transports you to this early, as you mentioned, like the nerve-wracking early gestation period of this musical. And as someone whose first exposure to it was the movie, I was like, oh, that's right. I suppose it was a Broadway musical first. So do you feel that the subject featured a good scope of insight with the people involved in those early periods? Or would you have preferred to, you know, get the perspectives of people who perhaps were missing?
Well, I think that the director did a good job of finding archival footage and interview footage with many of the key people who are dead now, in looking at, you know, their thoughts in how to creatively take material, which was basically a set of short stories. How do you stage them? Jerome Robbins is key to all of this. He was a great Broadway choreographer and director. He was involved with West Side Story, The King and I. And he was wrestling with a great many things at this point in his life, including his Jewish heritage. He had recently visited the village where his ancestors came from and was deeply moved in some way by that experience. He was also had the situation of being forced to name names during the McCarthy era. He had been at one time a member of the Communist Party or an associate of it, and he was blackmailed because he was a gay man, and he was forced to reveal the names of other members of the Communist Party. So he was dealing with the idea of persecution on three different levels, I guess you could say, in his background. And no, he did not want to make some kind of a depressing sort of a Samuel Beckett musical out of this. He wanted to find a way of communicating the essence and the spirit of all of these experiences. And the documentary, I think, does a great job in simple form of showing us how he did that.
The Yiddish stories of Sholem Aleichem in this documentary, you know, it's touched upon, but I would have liked a bit more examination. Just, I'm not of Jewish heritage, and I didn't even know the musical was based on these things. So
there is a documentary about him that's out there that's available.
Okay. But touching upon those stories, and, you know, the same thing kind of ties along with this documentary for any serious criticism the show may have had or its film adaptation. Do you think there was room for closer examination of going away from just the reverential view? More criticisms?
The downside of Fiddler on the Roof, well, I don't know exactly what that is. I guess I'm
Which I suppose is the point, yeah.
I'm on in the positive camp. I would imagine we could find negative reviews of it somewhere. I've never looked into how it was initially received by the theater critics of New York. But I think it is very instructive in the movie that Joel Grey, one of the people being interviewed for the film, he was involved in staging a belated Yiddish language version of Fiddler on the Roof, which makes great sense. He was talking about a Japanese friend of his who kept saying that Fiddler on the Roof is her favorite musical. And somewhere along the way, it's because it's so Japanese. So there we have it, I think, that you really don't have to come from the time and place represented in the musical to get something very meaningful out of it.
Storytelling has been among the most meaningful characteristics of not only the Jewish community, but it's a key point in keeping stories alive and keeping tradition alive along the lines of the main theme of Fiddler. And, of course, a strength. So do you have other films about the Jewish experience that you feel should get some attention or the same attention as Fiddler on the Roof?
Well, it could be a question, I suppose, for a whole episode of
right.
Of our program. I will have to think about it. I mean, the obvious answer is yes, but what would I recommend? I don't know.
Well, in considering the impact that Jewish either composers, writers, directors, producers, like it's Jewish, so ingrained in Hollywood.
Jewish influence on popular music, on Broadway, and on Hollywood is absolutely enormous. And certainly with Broadway and Hollywood, it's almost inconceivable to imagine if Jewish immigration had been blocked somehow in the 19th century, if no Jews had moved to America, if no other immigrants from Eastern or Southern Europe had moved to America, this would be a very different country. It would be one I think I'd be kind of bored to live in, frankly. And, you know, much of what we think of as the great films and the great theater of the last century, certainly, were done with the creative input and under the auspices, in many cases, of Jewish people who got into many of these fields because it was something, especially in the film industry, was a new thing. They may have been blocked into going into more traditional forms of enterprise in America at that time, but film was something that you know, was kind of lower class. It was sort of not, the boundaries hadn't been drawn yet. So there was easy entry there for immigrants. So it's an enormous story. I wonder if there really is one documentary that could tell the whole thing. Really, it's a Ken Burns series that should be made.
I think so.
You'd need to have multiple episodes to really get at the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Fiddler is just one piece of that scope. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is one of our regular film contributors. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the documentary Fiddler, Miracle of Miracles. It'll be playing as a part of the Milwaukee Jewish Film Festival this Sunday. You can find out more information about it at wuwm.com. We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk learns about the mosaics in Mitchell Airport's Concourse C. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Imagine you're rushing to catch a flight, maybe for business or a long-anticipated vacation. What's on your mind? If you're Dan Schley, you're wondering, what's the story behind the floor mosaics at Mitchell Airport?
It caught my attention, and I went, I'm just going to ask this.
Dan is talking about a massive piece of public art that spans the floor of Concourse C, the terminal that juts to the northeast at Milwaukee's General Mitchell International Airport. Spokesperson Pat Rowe escorts me to the beginning of the trail of 14 round mosaics. Their sizes vary from 15 to just over 3 feet, and so do their themes, but all are connected to Wisconsin. First up is Three Rivers. The mosaic points to Milwaukee's location at the confluence of the Menominee, Kinnickinnick, and Milwaukee. From there, the observant viewer finds him or herself on a journey along a lush landscape.
So you can see the color difference. It starts out as farm fields, and then you can see that as it gets closer to the lakefront, these become neighborhoods.
Along the way, an occasional leaf imprint made of bronze punctuates the scene. Called Aerial Wisconsin, it's one of nearly 20 projects created between 2000 and 2012, thanks to a special Milwaukee County program called 1% for Public Art. Pat remembers it was wonderful watching the mosaic creators at work.
Creative people who just loved what they do, and it showed, and they enjoyed having people watch them and watch the creative process.
It was a joyous time of our lives. We had a blast. Very proud of that project.
Yes, we are.
Calling from their studio in Miami, Florida, artists and partners Carlos Alves and J.C. Carroll say while they loved interacting with travelers, it made for more arduous art making.
Working in the airport while it's open, like, we had to keep all our materials underneath, so it was always up and down, through the gates.
Through TSA.
Yeah, through TSA.
Aerial Wisconsin took 4 years to complete. From 2004 to 2008, the team spent 1 to 3 months at a time installing Carlos's design, he estimates is a quarter mile long. JC says they want to give passersby the feeling they're already on an airplane, experiencing Wisconsin from on high.
There's a shadow of an airplane and clouds. That was the whole idea, to cover the whole of Wisconsin, like you're flying over it.
Different colored terrazzo, special flooring made from small chips of stone, including marble, creates the illusion. A crew poured the mixture section by section. Then at just the right time, JC and Carlos laid countless mosaic pieces in place. They had glazed, fired, cut, and finally numbered each tile in Miami so they would know what belonged where in Milwaukee.
And a lot of the tiles were different thicknesses, so as we're going along, we have to keep everything plumb.
He means level.
Then we use 15 colors of grout. as just the background, so only us that are cuckoo.
Maybe cuckoo, but you can hear even over the phone Carlos's joy in creation.
Sometimes we'd have two or three medallions going at the same time and we'd run from one to the other while things were drying. You know, like each one of those could take 20 hours just to install.
One of the last elements the team completed was an intricate arts mosaic featuring a gleaming white Calatrava. It seems to be made up of countless bits of tile.
The Calatrava is right there.
Yeah, there's a Calatrava.
It turns out the Calatrava is captured within another mosaic, a short distance from Concourse C, where airport meets parking structure. This one was not part of Milwaukee County's public art program, but rather was spearheaded by a local nonprofit called Sharp Literacy. Local artist Sally Dubeck coordinated the project titled Communities, Mosaic of Culture.
We decided to break it down into two parts. So it's places in the community, people of the community.
Sally's co-creators were third graders.
And so the first thing we would do is go into the classroom and have kids make drawings.
Their two big 9-foot by 16-foot murals hang across from one another, each packed with glittering, gleaming buildings and people.
Postmen, medical people, basketball player. Who else? Musicians?
The students drew them, and then Sally pulled their drawings together into giant compositions. She says they created the mosaic effect by gluing bits of costume jewelry, beads, and other found materials in place.
It would stay workable for a few days. So when we would finish an area, you could sprinkle seed beads into it also. So, or sprinkle some of this little stuff in there and just kind of press it in.
Among the 8 schools whose third graders contributed their talents to the creation was Milwaukee Sign Language School. Melissa LeClaire taught art there and remembers the joy her students experienced.
I remember kids walking around the art room with the necklaces on, you know?
Yeah, Melissa points way up at the top of the mural her students helped create.
If you look way up in the corner, you can see that piece of jewelry, and that was like the very last thing. And she stuck that in there, and I remember how exciting. I mean, we both looked at each other and said, it's finished. And
people rush past us, heading in and out of the airport. Artist Sally Dubeck, who, by the way, has helped to create 24 more murals throughout the area, admits she wishes people would linger and drink in the students' work. But watching kids create, she says, that's the real magic.
These elementary school kids are fearless. They have a can-do attitude about anything, and they'll just dive right in. There's no apprehension whatsoever, and their ideas are wonderful. They're so refreshing. I mean, I just look at those people in that mural. They're just wonderful. Like the girl with the parasol. I mean, I just love that. Well, I love them all. I mean, they're just fantastic.
Bubbler Talk question asker Dan Schley says he learned way more than he had bargained for when he asked about mosaics at Mitchell Airport.
Yeah, I'm glad that I did the whim to send a note.
Next time he's at the airport with a few minutes to spare, Dan plans to spend time with both pieces of public art.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus additional hotel rooms and Ember Salon and Spa, opening in August 2019. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.